the Talking Race podcast from the Centre for Race Education and Decoloniality at Leeds Beckett University. Professor Frank Keating is Professor of Social Work at Royal Holloway University of London. His research examines the effects of racism on black and global majority people. Professor Keating has over 40 publications, many of which focus on black men and mental health. He offers opportunities for black men to attend a voluntary group to talk about the effects of racism on their mental health. Thank you again, Professor Keating, for agreeing to be part of this podcast on race and mental health. I'd like to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about how you started your research in the area of mental health and racism.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I trained as a social worker many years ago in South Africa. And so I started my career as a psychiatric social worker in one of the largest psychiatric hospitals in Cape Town. This was in the apartheid days, and so it was quite an interesting time because the hospital was segregated. So all the white patients were on one side of the hospital and the black patients on the other side of the hospital. And there was a physical highway going through this hospital. And so I became aware of the inequalities then, because for the 400 white patients, there were 8 social workers. Mm-hmm. And for the 1,200 black patients, there were 3 social workers. And so I became really interested not just in the disparities between the patients, but also disparities in the staff. And we all got, and our pay scales were differential as well. And when I went to challenge this with the medical superintendent, he just said, don't be so radical, just wait a while. So I had that awareness with me all the time. And then I left South Africa to take further training. And when I came to the UK in about the 1990s, I then was still interested in mental health. That was my area of teaching. And then I had not expected that the disparities I saw in South Africa would be replicated in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I saw it here. And so I then became interested in understanding why, in a Western context where there's lots of resources, lots of money, why are black people faring worse in mental health? So that's sort of a starting point for getting interested in this very complex relationship between race and mental health, and why it is that the outcomes for black people in the UK were worse than their white counterparts. So that's where my work started. And then in 2000, I was approached by the then Sainsbury Centre for Mental Health to do a review of mental health services for African and Caribbean communities. And that sort of firmed my work. And most people will tell me that that was a seminal work in terms of the whole, the whole issue of race and mental health. And so we published a report called Breaking Circles of Fear. And it is still one of my most read reports, even though it was written in 2002. And from then on, my work had primarily focused on just understanding the whole connection or the intersection between race and mental health.
I think that what you're doing in terms of your work, it's incredibly important and also very topical right now. We're talking about mental health much more than I can think of in my lifetime. It's on the news agenda more and more, and there's this stigma behind mental health that seems to be being eroded, which is fantastic. And I've just got a question around the I guess, similarities or differences. Racism is a global problem. It affects people throughout the entire planet. And you mentioned about South Africa and the UK there. And I'm just wondering what the similarities or differences, is it the same kind of things that you're seeing from your experience, or is it different?
I think it's different because South Africa has the legacy of apartheid. The UK has the legacy of colonialism. And also in South Africa, we were talking about racism as a structural issue, whereas in the UK we don't talk about it as a structural issue. And even though after the Stephen Lawrence inquiry it was decided that racism is an institutional issue, and then that was confirmed with the Rocky Bennett case, and I had the privilege to work with Rocky Bennett's sister. This is a young man who died at the hands of 7 psychiatric nurses when he was on a secure ward. And that inquiry said that mental health services were institutionally racist. So I think, in the South African context, we have a more structural understanding there of the issues, and so people deal with it slightly more differently. Whereas here, we take an individualistic, medicalized approach. And I use a phrase, not my own phrase, but somebody else's phrase, where he talks about the invisibilization of race in policy. And so that race is seen as not part of the equation. It's not seen as part of the one of the determinants, or racism is not seen as one of the determinants of racial disparities. So those are some of, I think those are for me the fundamental differences, is that in the one context there is a structural approach to understanding some of these issues, and in the Western context it's often down to cultural insensitivity, it's down to the individual, it's down to people not complying, it's people seeking help too late. So the problem gets individualized and it's not located within a structural context.
Talking structurally then, as in many other sectors, you know, there are race disparities in pay and progression in careers. Are there similar disparities in mental health in terms of the treatment of black people, but also looking at staff as well, in terms of how many staff work in black BAME staff work in mental health?
Yes, there are significant disparities. The Theresa May's government had a racial disparity audit. In 2018, and in this audit it was found that there are significant disparities for particularly African and Caribbean communities in relation to mental health. So for example, they have far more adverse pathways to mental health, because we know that we have the NHS, and NHS is free at the point of entry. So one would expect that black people would come to mental health, the attention of mental health services, in the way that other people do, i.e. via their GP, but they don't. They come into contact with mental health services through the police, through the criminal justice system. And they also come at the attention of mental health services at crisis points. And so there's a different profile there. And then when they come into contact with services at crisis point, they are probably more likely then to be compulsorily admitted under a section of the Mental Health Act. So the statistics at the moment shows that black people are up to 13 times more likely to be compulsorily admitted. And then they are also more likely to be on seclusion and restraint when they're on psychiatric wards. That people are disputing this, but what patients are telling, or service users have told me, is that they feel they are over-medicated, and then they are less likely to be referred for things such as psychological therapies. Yes, and we also know that you know, black people are more likely to die in a psychiatric ward as opposed to other groups of people. So these disparities are there. They are also, the outcomes are worse, because our evidence shows that if you treat mental illness or mental ill health very early on, then people are more likely to be recovered. But if you come to the attention of services quite late, then you are less likely to recover. Mm-hmm. So these disparities, and they are deep seated. In my mind, they seem to be getting worse.
Right. Why do you think that is? Why is it that these disparities are getting worse?
I think it's a combination of factors. And in my work, service users have told me that a medicalized approach to their mental health issues is not sufficient, because the problems they're experiencing, and I, along with others, we call it social suffering, other people talk about racial weathering, mm-hmm. is that, you know, it's the impact of disadvantage, the impact of the power of institutions. And if that is not recognized, then people are going to have a difficult relationship with institutions. People will not want to engage with institutions they don't trust. If I get admitted to a psychiatric ward at the hands of the police, then already that will put me at a greater level of fear, a greater level of mistrust. It's natural that I wouldn't want to engage with mental health services. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's at the heart of the problem is, and this goes back to my whole notion of, if we don't take a structural approach to how we address these disparities, they are not going to go away. They are going to just become more deep-seated.
So are the explanations for why black and Asian and minority ethnic people don't seek out mental health services, are they currently rooted in cultural explanations rather than structural explanations?
Being a black man and dealing with mental health, I do feel there's a difference culturally, because I'm Nigerian, and from what I've seen with older men in my family, for example, my dad, he's one of my biggest role models, and I've never really heard him talk about how he was feeling or what he was dealing with. So being brought up in that environment, I thought that's just not something we talk about.
Yes, I do believe there is a lot of social pressures around how men should behave. And I think those messages appear very much when you're younger. I think straight away from sort of being born, really, in terms of, you know, boys wear blue and boys don't cry. And, you know, as you get older and into a sort of late teenagerhood, you know, you keep your stuff inside, you don't, you know, you bottle things up.
They are probably rooted in cultural explanations, and they are not located at this whole thing that, and the whole Black Lives Matter campaign at the moment is showing how black people do not trust our institutions. Mm-hmm. And for me, mental health, that's a key. So for me, if I think one of your questions are asking what does the NHS need to do, it's find ways of regaining, rebuilding, or even just building trust, because it's not there. You know, and so it's because if I want help from my GP, I would want to be confident that my GP is going to give me the best help. But if I don't trust that, if I don't think they're going to act in my best interest, then of course I'm not going to use that service. And it's not like a shop where I can decide whether I want to go to Tesco's, I can decide whether I want to spend my money at Waitrose, but I can't decide which GP I go to, I can't decide which psychiatric hospital I'm going to. There's a power imbalance. I have no choice. I will go where I'm being referred to, unless I have money to pay and I can afford private care. So I think it's this whole thing of the institutional mistrust. And the mistrust we see against the police, I think that is reflected in the mistrust against mental health services as well, unfortunately.
Thank you. In terms of my other question, I wanted to ask a little bit more about really the interaction between overt verbal and physical acts of racism and how they affect the mental health of children, young people and adults of colour. Is there a link between these things?
I think there is, and this is where the racial weathering theory comes in. It says, you know, that if you have a lifetime of disadvantage, social, economic, if you have a lifetime of racialized trauma, if you have a lifetime of racialized stress, you know, it's just natural that you will experience mental health issues. But the problem here is not just acknowledging that. The problem is then how do we work with that? Mm-hmm. If you provide a response that is purely about medication, purely about symptom control, purely about compliance with medication, then you're not going to resolve the issue. And I would also argue that these effects are cumulative. They build up over time. And therefore, it takes longer time to undo them. It takes longer time to deal with this. And I can give you an example from just a recent piece of work that I finished, because I was interested to talk to African and Caribbean men about mental health recovery, because this is a new policy thing in the UK where every service is meant to adopt a recovery-oriented approach or philosophy. But in my work, I've seen that black men don't recover, whatever this term means. And so I wanted to talk to black men who consider themselves to be in recovery and what that meant and what supported that recovery. And the men at first didn't want to talk about the recovery. They said, I want to talk about my life journey because it's my life journey that brought me here. And then when they started talking about their life journeys, and these were men who ranged, they were 30 men, some in Leeds and some in London, and their age ranges were something, I think, from about 24 to 55. And so there was variety there. But most of the men talked about racialized bullying at school, exclusion from school, violence in the family, violence in the community. And they all said that they felt that these events in their lives had an impact on their mental health experience. So it's a small sample, but it was an in-depth qualitative study, and these men gave vivid examples of how racialized trauma, racialized bullying, racialized stress, how all these things have had an impact on their mental health and their mental well-being. So I think there is a link, and of course it's not the same for everyone, you know, because I grew up in South Africa and I've lived in one of the most extreme regimes for part of my life. I'm fortunate that I have not experienced serious mental ill health, but I can still. And so we also have to understand that it's not everyone is going to be affected in the same way. So I think there is clearly a link there for me.
I think that you've probably alluded somewhere in that answer to the question I'm going to ask now, and Vinny mentioned about overt forms of racism or physical racism, but we've also got something called microaggressions, and these add up over time. So I just wondered if you could explain what microaggressions are and also how that links to mental health issues for young people of colour.
Well, I think microaggressions are those small little things that we take for granted. For example, I was on this project, I was working with a carer, a mother of looking after her two sons, and she was in the surgery, but she had to ring her daughter in Ghana in her home language, and she said, the moment she went to the front desk, she suddenly was treated differently because she spoke a different language. And that's a microaggression. Now, if you get that every time you go to your GP surgery, then that's going to have an impact on how you relate to them, how you want to use them, those sort of things. In my own life, I see the microaggressions. I walk into a shop and suddenly the security guard follows me about. And I'm a lighter-skinned black person. I'm not dark, and I don't fit this stereotype of big and black and all those sort of things, but I still get followed around, and that's a microaggression. So it's these little things, and so if you experience that on a daily basis, if you experience that all the time, they build up to become something bigger, and so it's again how we and I train my students to be aware of microaggressions, not just on issues of race. It's microaggressions on class. It's microaggressions on gender, sexuality, all those sort of things. So microaggressions, I think we don't take enough account of it. In fact, what people are now doing is something around unconscious bias. Microaggressions are not unconscious. They are there. They are in your face. I particularly in training social students, I try and make them aware of how microaggressions can impact.
A quick Google search will yield the dictionary definition of microaggression, which states a statement, action, or incident regarded as an instance of subtle, indirect, or unintentional discrimination against a marginalized group, such as a racial minority.
And I also wondered then, if microaggressions over acts of racism, do these, you mentioned the term racial weathering, so do these add up and cause changes, either physiological or psychological changes in the mind and body of people of colour, and how do those changes come about really to then result in racial weathering?
I suppose there are a couple of things that can happen. People sometimes internalise their experiences, and then they start blaming it on themselves. They start blaming themselves for what's happening to them. So that's one response. Somebody else can externalize it and can be very angry, can be frustrated. And if that anger is not acknowledged, if that anger is not understood, I often say, and what we've seen with Black Lives wasn't just anger, it was rage. So I think there's two ways in which this can work. So people internalize it and turn it in on themselves, and then start doing things that that are harmful to themselves and harmful to others, whereas other people may externalize that and therefore become aggressive towards other people, may engage in risky behavior with other people. So I think it can go either way. It can go an internal way, but also an external way.
Thank you.
Eshe says he understands why he ended up being restrained, but it frustrates him that it had to get to that stage. Black people are four times more likely to be detained under the Mental Health Act, and all too often, that's their first encounter with the system.
I think following up on that then, that's about the impact and what this does, but looking forward to the treatments, what treatments are available for trauma that's caused as a result of racism?
I mean, I don't think there's just one way of responding. I think it's for me, it's about treatments that speaks to the whole person. Now, this may seem commonsensical, But what service users have said to me, all they see is my diagnosis. All they see is my mental illness. All they see is my mental health and nothing else. And so what I'm arguing is you need to take a life course approach, an approach that understands how racism, how racialized bullying, how all these experiences have affected somebody's mental health. And then how you can work with them. For some of the men, they were saying to these 30 men we were talking to, for some of them, they were saying to me that this is the first time I've been able to speak to somebody about these experiences such in depth, and I found it so therapeutic. And I said, well, this is a research project, it's not a therapy project. But they said, look, I found this really therapeutic to be able to speak to somebody about these experiences and somebody to validate them, somebody to listen to them. So I think it's about something that speaks to the whole person. And in our study, we identified something called what we call the four pillars of recovery. And so it's about a safe space where people can share their vulnerabilities. But it's also about people's heritage, about their identity. And it's about rebuilding the relationship, because mental health, if it happens to somebody, it's quite a devastating experience. And people's relationships get affected in this. People's relationships gets destroyed. And so it's about rebuilding those relationships. And then lasting for these men, particularly if they've come into services via controlling methods, they want control back in their lives. And so it's about agency. And so I think so it's not so much about the individual treatments, really. It's about the philosophical approach and how we approach working with these men is what I would see as important.
It would almost be irresponsible for you not to find a way to deal with it. And I feel that the best way to deal with mental health is by getting advice, seeking help. It's not an easy subject to talk about, and you are leaving yourself quite vulnerable. But nowadays, it's becoming more acceptable. And without that first step, you will never climb the mountain. Nobody should have to suffer in silence because they don't feel it's macho.
One of the things I was very interested in was, do GPs and other health professionals, particularly mental health professionals, do they actually recognise the effects of racism on mental health, and particularly the mental health of people of colour?
I think it's difficult to say, but I think there are two responses. There are, for some people who are taking the view, in some of my work, somebody said, when we talked about misdiagnosis, somebody said, I'm a clinician. And that's the first thing they do. And so, what people in this recent study told us and saying that mental health professionals work to a script, mm-hmm. and the script does not include race or racism. The script is about the things that I talked about earlier, about compliance with medication, symptom control. So it's narrow clinical outcomes that people are looking for. And if people are achieving those, then the mental health professional will think that they've done their job. But it's the other, the other concerns in people's lives that does not get addressed. And I think where mental health professionals... because also in the, I've always argued, and I may be wrong, that in the British context, I think the Brits do not want to be named termed racist. And so what people are doing in the circles of fear work I've done is people were saying, well, we don't really use the R word. And if we really want to talk about racism, we'll do it outside the team meeting. We will do it in the pub. For me, it's about how we can create, for staff, a safe space where they can talk about it and say, look, I don't understand what is going on with this person. Now, I don't know whether that's racism or whether that's cultural or whether that's spiritual. And so, but it's about having an openness about that. But I also think that the other issue here is that to work with some of these deep-seated issues, it takes time. Mm-hmm. And in an environment, and that is now getting worse financially, I think some of us think that there's going to be a mental health pandemic, so to speak, after this, because I have noticed myself that I had just been to Australia for a study tour, and I came back 2 days before the lockdown, and I went into meltdown because psychologically I wasn't prepared for this, and I really panicked, and I thought, how am I going to cope for 3 weeks? What am I going to do? And with our current economic climate that seems to be getting worse, I think, it's going to even be even more difficult to do something about this. So getting back to your question about whether practitioners are acknowledging it, I think practitioners will try to acknowledge it, but then if there's not the institutional goodwill to support their work around this, then that's so I come back to the structural issue. So it's about not just the individual practitioner, but it's how their work, the institutional environment, facilitates some of this work. And so I'm working at the moment with the Ones with Community Empowerment Network and a trust in South London, and we are really looking at not just changing individual practice, but really looking at where are the block points in terms of the institution and how we can change those block points in the institution rather than focusing on individual practice.
So really, it's in all these years, the practice still seems to be, as you said, medicalized and almost blaming the victim. Surely, then that really calls for some training on race and racism, not just for mental health professionals, but all professionals, I would have thought.
And training has been tried, but I've always argued that if the training does not take place in the context of an institutional drive for change,
mm-hmm.
because then the training again places the responsibility on the individual practitioner, and it's not an individual practitioner's response solely. It's an institutional responsibility, and so whatever training is offered, I would welcome it, but I would suggest that training has to take place within the institutional context.
Yeah.
You mentioned the NHS previously, and due to the coronavirus, we're talking more about mental health, and there's been a lot of pressure being placed on the NHS in recent months. I'm wondering, if you had a magic wand and you could wave it at the NHS around helping people with mental health issues caused as a result of racism, what do you think should be done? And you mentioned there in the previous answer around education and how that should be coupled with institutional action. Is that the approach that you'd adopt there then?
I think I would do that, but I also think that I've always argued that when you couple mental health and race and racism, it's no longer a health issue. It's a social, political, economic issue. And so it requires a response that speaks to that. And so it's not just the NHS that needs to do something about this. It's about employment, it's about education, it's about, so it's broader, those broader things in life that's important, because what the service users are saying to me, they want to go to the gym, they want to go on holiday, they want to do all the things that we all value. And so it's how do we work together as a society to provide people with those sort of things rather than just saying, here's your medications, off you go and you're fine. They're not going to be fine. But I also think that certainly, again, in the project I'm doing with the Wandsworth Community Empowerment Network, is we think that more community-based services, services, you know, that, you know, that is anchored in the community. And we think that that will make a far bigger difference. Because as you earlier said, that there is stigma within the community, like in any other communities. And in some communities, there may be more stigma. I don't know. But there is stigma. And so, yes, and so it's about, and also in my work, I found that people would say that the support they valued most were those support offered by community organizations. And so it's how we can strengthen the community sector. Now, I think in the COVID, we had focused so much on the NHS. And I think, yes, that was right. But I also think that that was a middle class discourse. And I think we have neglected the voluntary sector and more so the Black voluntary sector, who have been working quietly, struggling. I've been trying to support small voluntary sector organisations in their work. And they've been working incredibly hard to support people. And all we do is we clap for the NHS. And then it took a while before we started clapping for the care workers in care homes. But nobody's talked about the grassroots level organisations which have kept things going, which have worked with reduced resources. And so for me, I think it really has to be a multifaceted approach, and that approach has to involve the community in a big way.
You mentioned the gym there before, and that kind of made me think about physical health. And with physical health, we're told to go to the gym to get fit, to eat right, to get on a treadmill, to go for a jog, and therefore you improve your physical health. I'm just wondering what your top tips are then for listeners to this podcast around mental health and protecting and improving our mental health, and particularly for people of colour that are listening to this. What are the top tips that you would offer for protecting your mental health?
I think the first thing about it is don't hide it. I mean, because of the stigma, you know, it's the first thing that people will do is will hide it. It's talk about it, find safe spaces to talk about it, because I think particularly for Black people, it's about this whole thing of how you hold yourself together when you live in this racialized society. And so oftentimes talking about your mental health is not something you want to do because you don't want to be seen as weak, because we also associate mental health with being weak. If I have asthma, I'm not seen as a weak person, but if I have a mental health condition, then suddenly I'm seen as more vulnerable, I'm seen as weak, all those sort of things. But the first thing I think is to not keep it to yourself. I think that's the very first thing. As I say, find someone you can talk to about, and find someone who will listen to you, and that's, for me, that's a key starting point. Because again, as I said, in the study with these 30 men, the thing they valued was us giving them time to talk about their mental health issue. And that seemed to be quite a valuable experience for them. So my top tip is just don't hide it, talk about it.
Many thanks to Professor Keating for his illuminating insights on race and mental health, an aspect which is often not talked about openly. It's not surprising that firstly, mental health professionals are unaware of race and racism when working with people of colour, and secondly, that racialised stress and how particularly microaggressions can lead to symptoms of racial weathering, which again affect the mental health of Black and global majority people. that information and knowledge seems to be absent from the training of mental health professionals. This is clearly an area which needs to be given urgent attention, particularly in the light of the pandemic. If you're interested in finding out more about Professor Keating's work, such as his paper on Black men's conversation on mental health through photos, or the report Breaking Circles of Fear, a review of the relationship between mental health services and African and Caribbean communities, then please check out his profile on the Royal Holloway website. Join us for the next episode of the Talking Race podcast, in which Dan Kilvington talks to Paul Campbell about race and sports commentary.